This film was approved under the Motion Picture Code of Self-Regulation.
And now...
We're thinking in terms of a film. The question is, what are we trying to do with this movie?
By George, that is a good question.
Is everybody happy?
And
let's go.
Hey, welcome to Film Frown. You're not too busy bopping your head like the Night at the Roxbury guys. this is the only show on the web where we're brave enough to watch an Elvis film sober. Hi, my name's Chris, and on this show we watch bad movies because, frankly, they make for a better podcast. It's hard to say anything about a good film when your jaw is hanging open excited in astonishment. And sometimes we're lucky enough that the movie is so bad it's actually good. It's entertaining, you might say. I'm not alone in this adventure. Tonto had his racially accepted Lone Ranger, and the Queer Eye Fab Five had their straight guy to be accepted by national TV audiences. So Canadian me has my American friend, web and audio ninja Paul. How are you this evening?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm very scripted. We have extra special guests tonight. Somehow I have managed to convince not one, but two amazingly bright and beautiful ladies onto the show. First up, we have a talented designer, a marvelous mom, and Paul's better half, Tina. Hi-de-ho, Tina.
Hello.
Also joining us is the super educator, world-traveling Wonder Woman known as my wife, Colette.
Hello.
Say hi.
Hi. I don't wait for instructions, sorry.
No, that's okay. You just ruined the script that I wrote. That was obviously a hilarious joke where I said, say hi to my mother and your dad, two of our 37 listeners. But whatever. Cool. Marital disputes on air. This is going to get us lots of ratings. That's why reality TV works. Go.
Whoop, whoop.
We should have watched the Fantastic Four with the four of us, you know? Like, Paul could be, like, Mr. Plastic, Rex Reed.
Sure.
Tina would be the Human Torch, because I can see Tina enjoy burning things.
Oh, yeah. I could get pissed off.
Colette would be the Invisible Woman because, hey, Canadian.
Hi.
No, she's Invisible Woman's very, you know, she's not offensive. She makes shields and she's invisible. She's not an offensive superpower. So more defensive. And I guess, would be the brash, offensive, heavy thing. So, before we jump into, maybe we should just keep talking and not discuss the movie.
Oh, no, I want to.
Oh, so I wanted to ask, my normal go-to question this season has been to be to ask what people's first movie memory is. But today I was thinking, I will ask you all, what's your favorite musical, Tina?
My favorite musical?
Yeah, cartoon, play, movie.
Oh my goodness. I really liked... Oh, it's a throw between The Phantom of the Opera and The Count of Monte Cristo.
Whoa, I didn't know that was a musical.
Well, I don't remember much music. I think the Oreos had some LSD in them. So The Phantom of the Opera, that was good. I liked that a lot.
Do you like the movie or the play? Or?
It's the actual movie. Like, we went and saw it. Was it Toronto?
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, we went and saw the play live. Oh, it's cool.
What about you, Colette? I know this is a tough question. She's actually a musical fan.
I do have a lot of musicals I like. I think my favorite would be The Pirates of Penzance.
Mm.
I saw it in Stratford in Canada, not Stratford-upon-Avon, but saw it at Stratford Festival when I was younger, and ever since then it was sort of a favorite. I like the one with Kevin Klein.
Is that the Pirates of Penzance? Is that the famous
modern General.
Yeah. Modern Major General. Yeah. Okay.
Wow, I don't think I've even heard of that.
Oh.
Now we have to pay royalties to that. Awesome. That song is often parodied. I think that Animaniacs did it. Like, I can't remember what it was.
Oh, maybe that's where I've heard that.
Yes. Yeah.
The lyrics are, you know, go really fast.
Yes. And I am the very
modern general.
Yeah. Got it. Got it. Yeah. Yep.
Oh. I'm not a musical fan at all, so I have a hard time.
It's caused strife in the marriage.
Yes. I have a hard time with the whole breaking out into song kind of a thing. But I'm lame, and like my favorite musical, if I had to pick one, would be like Moulin Rouge, because you already know the songs, so you can sing along. What about you, Paul?
I have not seen any of the movie versions of this, but I did go see Les Miserables when it was somewhat nearby. And I like that a lot.
Interesting.
I like that. I liked it live probably better than the movie.
But what's his name? Wolverine is in it. Does he have like a Wolvie Berserk style solo?
2, 4, 6, 0, shking!
Yeah, musicals.
Yeah. There should be a musical version of X-Men at some point. I'm sure that would be amazing. There is a... I did really like... I'm not sure if Tina particularly liked it, but I did like the musical episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Oh. No, I hate it when they do musicals for my favorite TV shows. It's just sad. It's kind of like, we can't think of any other part of the story to put in here, so we're just going to make some of this shit up. Yay!
I have to say, now that you mentioned that, recently, like this season, Supernatural, which is one of these shows I always say is a guilty pleasure, because it's not something like, oh, I missed it, I have to watch it. But if it's around, I'll watch it. And this season, they did a musical. So there's this, I mean, because it's a cheesy show, they've done shows like within shows and kind of stuff like that. And through some sort of mystical magic of some kind, because it's supernatural, there was an author who was writing their story and publishing books. And they stopped him because they were like, you can't tell people about this stuff. And they were just trashy novels and no one believed them. But then in a recent episode anyway, a high schooler wrote a musical based on the books. And then the show obviously went there because there was something scary happening in the theater. And it was pretty hilarious because the songs that they came up, basically they lampooned themselves. And they made, even though the two main characters in Supernatural are brothers, they made this sort of like gay tension in the musical, because musical are being cheesy. And so that was even funnier to see the boys, the actual stars of the show, watching this play out. They're like, hey, that doesn't happen. What is going on there? So, but the songs were hilarious. And they did, like, since that show, they often do like 70s songs, like in between like scenes and things like that, and driving scenes. So they did some covers, these little musical theater girls, of like hit 70s songs too. So it was kind of funny. I liked it. Like Carry On, My Wayward Son. All right, blah blah blah. I don't like Supernatural at all, so I just spent 20 minutes talking about it. So
buttons.
Nah, I was waiting for that. All right. We should probably tell the listeners live that we did in fact watch an Elvis film. And it's not necessarily one of his good ones, but that I'm not sure. The whole point of Elvis films is if you're an Elvis fan, you like them, and that's pretty much it, because you can look past everything to enjoy the film because you like Elvis. So sure. I'm not necessarily sure there is an Elvis film that's necessarily awesome. But that's just one man's opinion. And so I joked with Colette when we first started watching this last weekend. I was like, hey, we should drink every time Elvis delivers a line instead of sings. And basically we ended up being teetotalers. So
yeah, he does not have very many standalone non-sung lines, does he?
No,
that's an Eddie Murphy joke, but yeah. So the movie's Harum Scarum, and it starts with these like awkward like cutout pictures of mountains during the titles. It was like, let's photograph a mountain, but then I'm gonna like cut it out along its ridges, and so it's just this weird shape.
Well, it looks like a collage my grade twos would do for a poster or something like that. It was very amateurish.
That's a good point. That's like, it's one of those like collage assignments that I had as a kid where you would just cut stuff out of a magazine. And it was even complete, I have in my notes, complete with half-ass zooming, which was just sort of like stop motion zooming into like one picture. It was like, here's a person and a horse, and let's get closer, and let's get closer. It wasn't very smooth. But the song is probably, I have my notes, it's the most energy in all the songs in the film, and I assume that's probably because we can't see Elvis. I was reading some reviews of this film from the day, and there were people like, because Colette had even mentioned it, his performance in this film is entirely flat. Mm-hmm. It's like even other Elvis films, like he'll do some stuff. He's Elvis. He just has to shake his hips and like we fall over and pass out. But in this film, he's just like sort of like phoning it in. And
yeah, definitely.
The script doesn't help. Neither do the songs. But anyway, the song opening during the show, during the opening here is Harum Holiday. And I can dramatic read some lyrics if you like. But he's like, 20 women by my side. I'm going to kiss them all because I've got to keep them satisfied. I'm going to be flying high on a harem holiday. If Romeo had a harem holiday, you bet that Juliet would have never been his girl forever.
What?
Yeah, I know. The lyrics were like worse than the dialogue. Which, yeah, that's an interesting statement because so you think Juliet's like sort of a one woman. She's into monogamy, like. I can get behind that. So she doesn't like the idea of Romeo having a harem?
No, I think it's the other way around. I think if he had harem, he wouldn't have like...
needed Juliet?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He'd have been like, I'm banished. Oh, well, I have a harem.
Yeah. I don't need to like, you know, poison myself and wait to be woken up mysteriously. I, you know, have other women...
I have an entire harem.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So Colette was like, she had high hopes in the beginning because she called the first scene very meta because we see Elvis in a desert fighting some dudes. And then we see it's just a film and Elvis is in the crowd watching himself. And there's a bunch of other people there. And on screen, after he defeats the baddies, he has to fight a vicious jaguar. they dance around each other and the coolest thing happens. The jaguar is like, I'm totally going to jump at you and claw you to death. But Elvis is like, I'm waiting for this. And he gives the jaguar a precisely timed karate chop. And then the jaguar is just on the ground, presumably dead.
Yeah, but then you see the chain.
Yeah. Yeah.
They didn't even like try to edit that part out. Well, he's supposed to be this wild jaguar.
I said that to Colette. I was like, oh, I saw a chain, but now I don't. And she's like, no, the chain's been there the whole time. And I was like, so why did he even have to fight the jaguar? I don't understand, because then he like saves a woman tied to a post. So was the jaguar like just chained far enough away from her to scare her, or so no one could get near her?
If we're going to investigate each bizarre moment, we're going to need like a 20-hour podcast.
We need Adam Savage from Mythbusters on to help us investigate these things, because they do all these like crazy measurements from films.
It could be a whole season.
Yes. Just the one film. Kill Me Now.
We're investigating all the myths of Harum Scarum.
I'm going to interrupt Chris. This is unscripted, sorry, but I actually looked up Harum Scarum, and it's in the thesaurus. And what I thought was interesting is some of the name synonyms are disorderly, erratic, haphazard, and thoughtless. I thought that was a really good synopsis of the film, actually. Just go to the thesaurus for Harum Scarum, and there you have your synopsis for the film.
Wow.
That's nice. Good.
Well done.
I thought it was Harum Scarum because it was Scarum scare the audience away. It was such a terrible film.
It was. Oh.
The great thing is at this point, Elvis has already been in two movies, because he's on the movie that's on the screen and he's in the actual movie that you're watching. So he's Elvis as Elvis. As Aladdin at this point.
Yes. It gets really mind-blowing if you haven't had the Oreos.
Oh, man, Oreos.
In the film that they're watching, he frees this woman, and then, of course, he has to sing a song called My Desert Serenade, which the song basically says, look, you've got to hear my serenade, which is the song you're singing now. So the song is about me singing a song. So listen to me sing about how I'm going to sing to you. It was like, I was looking at the lyrics and there was nothing like, I love you or any of that. It was like, hey, I'm going to serenade you. I thought that was really strange. So the movie ends and all the sheiks and their ladies applaud the film, which is called Sands of the Desert. And Elvis gets up and someone introduces him, and he's going to sing a song to the folks live. And that at this point, I was... Like I said, Eddie Murphy makes an excellent joke back in the day how Elvis can't sing or can't act, so he just sings all his lines. And at this point, we are 6 minutes into this film, and this is the third song.
Yeah, that's what I have too. I'm like, he's not selling the song. First of all, he's not selling the songs at all. He's like, he looks like he's been injected with all the Botox that they had at the time that they made this movie. And so far, there's a song every 3 minutes.
Yes. And he's singing a song called Go East, Young Man, where he says a lot of silly things, mostly stereotypes. I have some of the lyrics. I'm going to go where the night's enchanted, go where the dreams are granted. When paradise starts calling, into some tent I'm crawling. I was like, what? Wait, man, someone buy Elvis's writers a rhyming dictionary. Damn it for the internet to not exist then. And Colette, this is the point where you were wondering what the hell is going on with that female lead who was watching him, Aisha. Because she's watching him and her mouth was like opening and closing.
Yeah, it looked like she was speaking, but she clearly wasn't. It was
completely like, forgot to ADR that scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's like, is she singing along? And I was like, she's just rapt by Elvis's presence. So her mouth is falling open. It's cool.
Repeatedly.
Repeatedly. Yeah, it was weird. And then after that, the ambassador from the U.S. To this country where they premiered the movie, he introduces Elvis to a bunch of people. And it's what I love is this ambassador guy is like not the greatest actor. There's very few in this film. And he introduces like, because Elvis's name in the film is Johnny Tyrone. He's like, well, this is General so-and-so and his lady. This is Prince so-and-so and his lady. So the ladies don't even get names. And at one point when he introduces the royal prince, who is a main character in this film, it's hilarious because he's like, and this is his royal highness and his lady, Johnny Tyrone. Like, he just blurs it all together, the line. So it's like, his lady's named Johnny Tyrone? I thought Elvis was named Johnny Tyrone. It was kind of silly. And he's this ambassador guy who is just sort of, like, throwing these lines out. He's kind of a creeper because he never looks at anyone. He just can't take his eyes off of Elvis. Like, the prince and Aisha, who we are introduced to, they invite Johnny to their kingdom of Lunacan. And then the ambassador jumps in. He's like, hey, they've never let anyone go there, Johnny. You'd be the first American ever. And he's like, well, that's interesting. And then he's like, hey, you were going to take a break after this filming anyway. You should go. And I was just like, okay, just let you know, he can't even get a word in edgewise. and then, like, when the prince and Aisha are talking, the ambassador guy is just, like, staring at Elvis. Like, I'm next to Elvis. So anyway, the kingdom of Lunacan is 2,000 years behind. Colette took issue with that. They haven't had any visitors there or let the outside world in or technology for 2,000 years. And you had done the math at that point.
So, well, it would have been like
Mesopotamia.
No, it would have been later than that. But it was just, yeah, it was a lot of the stuff they had was didn't quite jive with that timeline. But that was early in the film when I was actually still had a hope for some authenticity. But, you know, what I thought was interesting related to authenticity is Elvis was the one that had the deep tan.
That's right.
And everyone else, they made no attempt to make anyone else look Middle Eastern except for the one actor who was actually Syrian born. But I just thought I was like, he's supposed to be American. Why are they making him look Middle Eastern? But yeah, I gave up at worrying about how authentic everything was at that point.
So in this conversation, Elvis is like, oh, well, how can I turn down such an awesome invitation? And the prince, the royal highness, he's like, great, the car will pick you up tomorrow at 8 a.m. So you're a big singer, actor, and obviously cat killer. So you don't have any plans, right? We'll just pick you up tomorrow. And then we cut to your awesome plane scene and then horseback riding through the desert. And then we get a little shot of the Elvis and the prince sitting by a fire. I'm sorry, the royal prince, not prince, the artist. that would have made a more interesting movie. talking about more bad actors. That's what we need. So Elvis... Yeah.
And this entire scene, I'm expecting a red shirt to walk by in the background because they're literally camping on the set of Star Trek, the original series, like a planet that they would visit.
Yes, this is true. And Elvis is at, he asked the prince, so Aisha, like, you know, are you guys like a thing? And the prince gets up and says, hey, I'm going to go to bed. But Aisha, she's just Aisha. And then she comes out in a spiffy pantsuit.
Spiffy.
And they make out because Elvis.
There's no real dialogue. It's just she's just going to come distract him with her wiles and then poison him. Foreplay, poison.
I thought it was great.
Yeah, Colette was like, whoa, didn't they just meet like yesterday? But I mean, he's Elvis. Like, what do you? Oh, I'm getting it. So you're not a fan of Elvis? You don't think he's hot, Colette?
Now, I never really got on the Elvis bandwagon. I think because I was young enough that, like, I'd seen him, like, I grew up with the old Elvis, and then, you know.
Yeah.
So, like, I didn't know, and you know, until I got older, kind of did the, you know, saw he's, other pictures of Elvis. Oh, that's what he looked like originally. So it was kind of already tainted. Like, it was.
Right. He was a creepy older guy wearing a white sequin suit already by the time you were aware of him.
Yeah, I don't understand the Vegas Elvis at all. So that was a turn off. When the 8-year-old me was really turned off by that. You know, so I never recovered.
It's true. Like, I was going to compare it to Ricardo Montalban, right? Because I, as a youngster, I know him from Fantasy Island, a very dignified and handsome man. And then when you watch Wrath of Khan and Star Trek, you're like, oh my God, who is this ugly dude?
Why won't he put on a real shirt?
Tina, are you attracted to the Elvis?
Oh man, I thought he looked just like my grandpa. I was fascinated.
Interesting.
I would say to my mom, "Oh my God, grandpa's on the TV."
I don't know. I'm secure enough in my own masculinity to say that I think he's a fairly handsome man. I think what does it for me, I think the sexual tension starts with the lip curl.
But he didn't do that in the movie at all.
He didn't do that, yeah.
No, I know. You're right. Like, he maybe that's so why this flat. Movie's flat.
There was no hip action. There was no lip curl.
He was so stoic. Like, he was, I don't know, injected with something. And they just kind of, like, made him move around.
I think if he had killed the jaguar with his hips, I would have bought it better.
You're sick.
And then did the lip curl after, you know, in triumph.
That would be even a better way to kill a jaguar, lip curl.
It just drops dead.
Yeah. Yeah. He was just so flat in this movie. That's the unfortunate part, because, like, there is, like, an Elvis out there somewhere in the history where, I mean, if he were to walk by in our hallway here in the condo and he said, "Oh, don't go in the bathroom, I just had some diarrhea," I would be like, that's the sexiest thing I've ever heard. If he did the lip curl.
I have no words.
Because you're totally impressed by my Elvis impression. Awesome. So as Paul inferred, he drinks from a goblet and passes out because he's been poisoned. And some guys with hats with built-in widow's peaks come and grab him.
That was weird.
I know. They were like the cult of the Butch, whatever his name is, from the Monsters TV show. Eddie. So then we cut to the king of Lunacan. Is that what it's called? I think everyone pronounces it differently in the film. The second time I watched. I did watch a second time. I'm crying inside. So we cut to the king and his daughter, and they're playing chess. And we know this is a very old country because the king is petting his dog, which is the oldest breed.
It was an Afghan.
Yes, it was an Afghan dog. Such detail in this film. A servant comes in and she introduces the prince's return, and he says to the king, "Guess what? Like, the assassins took Johnny Tyrone." And at this point I was like, "What? Like, this group needs a better marketing team because they're just called the Assassins." So the king and the prince say, "Oh, hey, let's keep my daughter safe. We'll send her to the palace in the mountains."
Yes, you are a helpless, nearly naked woman. This is no place for you.
So then we cut to, oh man, it's been such a long time before we have a song. So Elvis is singing a song, basically saying, "Is your love a mirage that will fade away?" Which is quite poetic for this film.
So I'm wondering at this point if they actually abducted the invisible band as well.
I know. Yes. I know.
No, I think that's all in his head, Paul.
See, See, if it was like a good musical, which I have a hard time finding them myself because I'm not a fan, but if it was a good musical, you wouldn't be asking those questions, right? But
well, I mean, in most of the in the between 300 and 700 songs he's sung thus far in the movie, there's been a reason for there to be music around. Like in one song, he's on a stage. In another song, he's in a movie that we're watching, which could presumably be a musical. But in this case, he's just like, there's randomly music and he kind of wakes up and he just starts singing.
No, I'm with Tina on this, because he sings this song surrounded by these ladies. And then at the end of the song, he quickly falls back down and closes his eyes.
Yeah, he sort of refaints and he wakes up.
So I think the whole song was a dream, therefore in his head, and therefore the music.
Mm-hmm. My wife, right. I can buy it.
My wife is like, I'm going to use the computer now. You're bored. So he wakes, and let's see. Oh, he says something like, where am I? And one of them says, well, you're in the Garden of Paradise. And he's like, I could have told you that. Boom.
Only you delivered it better.
Yeah,
you did. Yes. Totally.
That's there's some really good like action movie or comedic one-liners that Elvis has in this film that are just sort of dropped because of his performance, unfortunately. But some assassins come in and they break up our possible orgy scene. So 12-year-old me is upset. And they say, hey, we have to bring you to the Lord of the Assassins. And then Elvis muttering what I'm thinking, because I still can't get over the fact that the name of their group is Assassins, says, you got to be kidding. Aisha comes in. And she comes in, does a little flirt, and says the Lord of the Assassin wants to put him to work. And Elvis is like, oh, you told him I killed the cat.
Yeah, I know.
That's weird.
It was sort of like, up until then, I hadn't made the connection, and probably no other audience member had. So I was like, we need to tell the audience why he's been abducted. Oh, because he killed the cat. I was like, what?
Yeah, yeah.
So I was waiting for it to be like, no. That's really why he was abducted, because he karate chopped a cat in the movie.
Right.
Wait. A cat or the jaguar?
The jaguar. Yeah.
But they kept calling it a cat in the movie, I think, didn't they?
Yeah, well, yeah.
It was just Chris that kept calling it
a cat. I'm not sure that Elvis knows the difference with his character, Johnny Tyrone.
Well, and the thing that he says, too, is that his hands are to be used only for self-defense, which I think is hilarious, because what he should have said was, that was a movie, I didn't actually kill any jaguars.
Yes, I was thinking like, okay, maybe we're to believe in a universe where people break into song, there's no such thing as movie magic. And he actually killed those men and karate chopped a cat.
Yeah, yeah. I think it would have been funnier if it was like, well, these people have never seen a movie. They're 2,000 years behind, so they can't tell that he actually didn't kill the cat. But instead, he just like totally plays it like, no, seriously, I'm Elvis. I can just karate chop animals and they're dead. That's it.
The only other way I thought of to explain this sort of weirdness is perhaps that film that we were watching in the beginning, in the film within a film was, in fact, a documentary.
It's a film within a film where he sings a song about a song, and it's a documentary.
Yes.
It's reality TV.
So it gets even richer, because the Lord of the Assassins, like, let's get this straight, he presumably is the best assassin in the group. And is the Lord of them, and they're a bunch of assassins. They need Elvis to kill someone. So the assassins are hiring an assassin.
Yeah.
I'm really at this point ready to stop. And then Elvis, he tries to karate his way out of this, but like 7 guys jump him, and now he's back in the garden, in a pretty Arabian costume instead of his street clothes, as the girls tend to his bruised back. And like I just said, for whatever reason, he was in like his normal American rock and roller clothes. And then in the next scene, he's in his Arabian outfit, his Aladdin outfit, whatever you want to call it. But whoever changed his clothes for him was kind enough to put his wallet in those new clothes. Because here comes our friend Zaka, who tries to steal his wallet. And I like to call Zaka glue, as he's the only one who holds this plot together.
I like how Zaka is like, I mean, he's acting so much he's practically chewing on the scenery. And he's just trying to compensate every which way he can for stone dead Elvis. Yes.
And everyone else in the film, too.
And everyone else in the film as well. Except maybe the real king.
Maybe he just like sucked it out of everyone else.
Could be. That's with his eyes.
Flat. He has some kind of power where like everyone else's energy and animation is like zapped into him and his crazy eyes.
Elvis is a muse. Yeah. So Sokka, he's like your stereotypical Middle East con man from movies. So he's part of the Guild of Thieves and calls everyone most honorable and noble. And yeah, he's chewing all over the scenery, which is from like a Cecil B. DeMille film or something. It was a recycled set.
Yep.
So they make a deal. Elvis says, I'm going to give you lots of American cash. If you help me escape. And he's like, oh, you know. So he's got a bunch of flowery scripted words and he's acting like crazy. But he does need some scene direction or something to do while he talks to Elvis, and they fade out. So they both just grab bananas to eat. But it's like, what? Okay, I'll help you escape. But first, bananas. So that was just like, why is
I did think that was funny. And this is the most excited you see Elvis in the film as well. He's like, I can't believe how starving I am, actually.
Truthfully, as I read about this film, Elvis was really excited about the premise and the costumes, like he wore them home. That was like in Priscilla's like biography. But once he got to the set, like the first day and started working, like he realized that it was not going to work. And so some people say that's why the energy is so low. And he even like, I can't remember. He signed something like to the director, like an album cover or something. And he signed it and he's like, we'll get it right next time. So I guess there's good, evidence to say that he wasn't in this film. Anyway, Zaka and Elvis hide in the pool using the old breathe through a reed trick. I mean, it's a reed, right? It's not bamboo. Like, where would they get bamboo? I don't know.
I really stopped overthinking at the beginning scene. So
they climb the wall after some karate. The fight choreographer was sick that day. And at this point, when they climb the wall and they've karate chopped this one guard, then they jump over the wall and seven guards appear. But the audio would have you believe that there's 35 people in the room. It was kind of silly. And so they're running away from the guards chasing them. And they say, okay, let's split up and we'll meet somewhere. So, how's your geography, Tina? You know where you're going everywhere? I was just like, I have an American education and, I'm not sure that I could point out all 50 states on a map. But Elvis knows his way around Lunacan.
Yes, he does.
Oh, he's like, oh yeah, I'll meet you at the pool. No problem. Like what? oh, well, we're accepting the scene. So Elvis, he scales a wall that he runs into, and he jumps onto this little gazebo thing and slips and falls and ends up in the water.
What a turd.
I know. And he's getting into the little gazebo thing, and there's a woman in there. It's the king's daughter just hanging out. And he tells her the story about what happened, that he was captive in this place just up the hill a bit. And she's like, oh, no, that's a nice little old man. And she's like, he's like, no, it's the assassins. And she's like, oh, no, I have to warn my my master. So she doesn't say she's the princess. She's just a lowly slave girl, really dressed to the nines.
Sitting totally. Luxuriously in a gazebo on the side.
Yeah.
Slave girls have a pretty cushy life in the 2000-year regressive land. And I also have to wonder, the thing that popped out, I don't know why it didn't pop out to me earlier, but if they're 2,000 years behind, why does everybody speak perfect English?
I know.
Yeah.
Except Zaka. Zaka has at least like a hint of some kind of a, he's trying to throw some kind of an accent on it at least, but pretty much everybody else is just straight English.
Yeah, I couldn't decide if it was like sort of like a Star Trek translator thing. Like we were to be imagining really they were speaking their own language, but we're hearing it in English due to movie magic. But sure. That still doesn't explain how Elvis can communicate with them all.
Yep.
Through song.
Right.
So Princess says, hey, I'll help you. I got an extra horse. We'll go get your friend. And so they come to the pool where Elvis is supposed to meet his buddy. And, he, you know, they're alone. So Elvis flicks on the charm switch. he says, hey, I'd love to take you back to Hollywood. And she says, oh, I'm only slave girl. so then what does she say? She's like, I'm just a lowly slave girl. And he's like, he says something like, something about how can I like free you from your master? Before that we have the Kismet song.
Oh,
favorite because
it's terrible. This is, I think, the worst song in the entire thing because it's just so repetitive. Like that. Oh, I'll use the word Kismet and then I'll use it 500 more times because it's nobody ever hears that word. So I'm going to make up for that. Apparently.
Until you came by, Kismet, and I were strangers. But now that you're here, it's suddenly clear that we've met. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, what? Yes, this was my least favorite song in a movie full of least favorite songs. So he's like, wants to know how he can like, you know, convince her master to give her to him. And she's like, well, hey, why were you kidnapped? And Elvis is like, oh, I'm supposed to kill some important guy. And so she jumps on the horse and takes the other two with her, runs away. So Sokka has been watching from the bushes. Let's just hope that he just arrived. I don't want to think about what he was doing in the bushes otherwise. And he tells Elvis, like, he'll sneak him to the next town with a troupe of musicians and will escape, like, after the Feast of Ramadan, which is now, like, a phrase we're going to hear 100 times because they want to make sure we're clear of the plot. actually, earlier when they sent the princess to the mountain hideaway, like, she's like, Daddy, you have to come with me. You're the king. And his brother, the uncle, the royal prince guy, he delivers like some line like, well, he can't. No king has ever been away from the kingdom during the Feast of Ramadan. And he's like, after the Feast of Ramadan, I'll come join you. And she's like, okay, I guess I'll go to the mountains. He's like, and I will be there after the Feast of Ramadan. It's like, okay, I get it. Stop. So, let's see, they, They're going to go meet the troupe of musicians. But meanwhile, we've got to go back to the princess, who returns to the palace and she warns her pop, the king of mustaches. and the prince and the king agree, like, hey, we better send men to that house in the mountains and attack those darn assassins. And then there's more like, yes, let's attack them. And, you know, and then we'll have the Feast of Ramadan. And I'm like, shut up already. it's a musical, not Quantum Theory. I get it. After the Feast of Ramadan. And
then, there's a song about the Feast of Ramadan.
Yeah, an Elvis song. So then this is the first half of the film. And the second half of the film, I like to call Bongo the movie. It's the only real instrument that we have in the scenes to make Paul happy that there's some music available.
Yes, tambourines and bongos.
And they overplay it. It's like, hey, we need some songs. Hit the bongo. It is even awkwardly like mixed over or into the actual songs that we're hearing. It's kind of weird. But Elvis is watching the dancing troupe, who our friend Zaka tells us are sapphire, amethyst, and emerald. I was waiting for, like, you know, some other like sisters to pop in, like basalt and mica. This is their sister shale. And of course the bongo player, Julma. And then we get introduced to the amazing Billy Barty, who's been in lots of films and TV shows, very famous person suffering from dwarfism or dwarf. And he did a lot of, when I was looking at his information, he actually did a lot of political things to establish things for dwarves.
Little people.
Well, yes. In his day, it was. Yeah, so you're right. I don't know. It's funny because I just listened to another podcast with Gilbert Godfrey, and they were discussing the whole difference now. Like, you can't say midget, that's wrong, that's little people. So then what are dwarves? It was this whole like horrible conversation of what to call politically correct. Anyway, so Elvis is watching the ladies and he's like, yeah, I better go help them so they can make some money. And Zaka's like, oh no, you don't need to do that because that's what he does. And Billy Barty goes and he steals from people while they're watching. And this song, like, you're almost like, oh my gosh, I think Elvis might be moving his hips, but he's just hitting it with a tambourine every now and then.
Right. And it's not even choreographed very well to go with the music.
Oh.
I feel like you're watching it and all of the tambourine hits are completely off the beat. And
yes.
Well, we were reading something after, too, that apparently he even flubbed up on some of his lip syncing in the movie. I would have said I didn't pay close enough attention, but apparently. So I'm not surprised that the tambourine didn't quite hit on the correct beat either.
Good Lord, I'm glad I fell asleep by this point.
Oh, yes. Every night they're dancing on those marble floors. Kings may bow before them, but they'll be my own. They'll shake their thing for me alone. Shake, shake, shake the little tambourine. Shake a ring a jingling.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah. To be fair to the people who wrote these songs and Elvis, I'm sure if I were to read Taylor Swift's lyrics as flat as I read those, they wouldn't sound very impressive either. So, like I said, Billy Barty's running around as a little person, stealing things, just cutting people's money purses off of them, and someone catches him, conveniently, as the song ended. So he and Elvis and Zaka, they are running away, and they think they've lost everyone, so they do like the comedic, like, let's just walk nonchalantly and whistle kind of a thing, and then the bad guys find them again. I'm surprised they didn't do like a, you know, Laurel and Hardy, like, scoot or something. Just like, and there's like this fight scene with the guys trying to catch them. And it was mostly unmemorable, except these two kids start hurling rocks at people with slings. The children escape with them to Zaka's Palace of Jackals, where Jolna and the Tambourine Girls are waiting.
Well, and the fight scenes all seem quite like slapsticky, a lot of the fight scenes.
Yeah.
And so you start to go, oh, maybe this movie is a farcical movie. But then the acting starts and you can't tell if they're trying to be serious. Like, is this a farce? Is this poorly acted? Or, like, you know, and then the fight scene happens. You're like, oh, this is very silly. I think this is a farce.
Yeah.
It's a movie that I found didn't really know what it was. So it was a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I have in my notes that the music, when it's not Elvis singing music, it's just soundtrack music. All of the choices for that seem very strange because it's like the plot of a James Bond movie with the soundtrack of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. It's just really weird. And like you say, it would work if it was really like overtly farcical, but it doesn't hit that note 100% of the time. So it doesn't fit.
Yes.
There's too many people who are like the straight actors. Then yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not Kismet. It's not.
And we do have a listener who pointed out during Chris's rant about Ramadan that, that, you know, 2,000 years ago, this society has been, you know, lost to the world for 2,000 years. Yet it's an Islamic society. But you have to remember that Muhammad was actually born at around like 570. So
yeah,
yep. At some point, maybe, you know, 1,500 years ago or 1,400 years ago, something went into that society. To bring them Islam.
Right. Right.
And change the whole religious structure.
Whoa.
Anyway, again, don't overthink it.
Yeah, don't overthink it.
This is Colette's favorite part because the children tell a story about how they lost their parents and they've been adopted by Emerald and Shale and all these other diamond the dancing ladies. And Zaka, who basically owns them and the dancing girls, and there's more repetitive dialogue about, hey, like, I thought we were getting out of here. No, we're going to hide out here until after the Feast of Ramadan. And then after the Feast of Ramadan, we're going to go and escape. Anyway, there's a great line in here where Zaka is, like, introducing Elvis to the crew, the people here in the Palace of Jackals, where he says, this is, you know, Johnny Tyrone, and he's an American. That means nothing. He's rich. That means everything.
Right.
I just really like that means nothing. So anyway, everyone is like, hey, maybe you could like buy us from Zaka and free us from him. And Elvis is like, oh, thanks for laying that on me.
Right. And they call Zaka the root of all evil more times than they've said Feast of Ramadan in the next 3 minutes.
I know. That was the first time I heard it. I was like, I didn't really register it. And then suddenly they kept saying it. I'm like, when did that happen? And now they keep saying it. I felt like I missed some kind of thing where, you know, he was really mean to them because he seemed quite gentle with them, and
he seems very benign.
Yeah,
as a slave master.
Well, and what's awesome is, as Paul pointed out, he's the only actor in this film. So, like, when they call him the root of all evil, there's like a wide shot where like he sticks his tongue out at them because he's like, "I'm acting. How right. dare you call it that?"
He keeps rolling his eyes and making silly faces at all of them.
Yeah. So anyway, he sends Zaka off to find the slave girl that ran away from them because, you know, he rode on a horse and talked to her while he was soaking wet in a gazebo. So he's like head over heels in love with her.
Totally.
Yeah.
That's kismet.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
Good one. Yes. And so Sari, the little girl, one of the children, she's like, hey, I'm going to be a slave girl when I grow up. And Elvis is like, whoa, 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 whoa. Let's, you know, we don't have to do that. And she's like, no, I can really dance. Check me out. And begin creepy, inappropriate songs.
Yes.
So creepy.
Very creepy. And the thing is, this is probably the most Elvis-like song in the entire movie.
It is.
Yeah.
And it's used in the creepiest possible context.
I mean, you can't, this is really a sight you have to see to understand just how creepy this is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like some producer is like, you know, slapping himself high fives like, oh, in the movie, he's singing to this cute little girl. But then when people buy the albums, the ladies will think he's singing to them. We'll sell lots of them.
It was disturbing.
It reminds me of the Christian boy band song that was sung on South Park.
Like, which one?
It's just completely used inappropriately.
Yes, Colette. She's covering all the fines. So she's like, you have to play a clip of that.
Creepy.
Yeah, she's remixing too.
Come on and dance with me.
She's like, what, seven?
Are you about the cutest thing I ever did see?
Creepy, 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 creepy. Hey,
little girl, I'd like to take you home.
Really creepy.
Come on, come on, come on. I want you for my very own.
Oh, boy.
It's so not nice.
It's terrible. Terrible. And if you took that, you know, if you take it out of the context that he's singing this to like a 10-year-old girl who's dancing around in rags and shaking her hips, honestly, more than Elvis does in the entire movie,
yes.
It wouldn't be bad if you just heard Elvis singing that song on the radio.
Right.
But yes, it's terrible.
Yes. And it's funny because we do know him for his hip-shaking awesomeness, but I'm not really sure that there's ever, like, an Elvis movie where he's really Gene Kelly. So
part of true.
Are they keeping these dance steps in this part simple for the little girl or for Elvis? Because literally, like, one of the steps is, like, jump forward and shuffle your shoulders a little bit.
Right.
I guess maybe they were trying to make it less saucy because he is singing to like a 7-year-old.
Play peekaboo around this column.
Yeah.
Yes. So then we cut to everyone sleeping and the assassins arrive. And Aisha is wearing her leather Tascadero outfit. That's for you Happy Days fans. It's just like this jumpsuit and an obnoxious scarf. Unfortunately, not leather. But Aisha threatens basically to kill the children unless Elvis kills the king. Meanwhile, at the palace, the princess sees Elvis in a pool of water and he serenades her.
Oh.
Yes, this song is right there with Kismet. Like, it's pretty bad. Like,
yeah. And it's way too long.
Yes. And when you listen to the lyrics, like, this song is just as awesome as the last one because he's basically calling her a hooker. He's like, golden coins I will bring to you, silver trinkets and rubies too. In return, dear, I'm begging you for the pleasure of love. So, I'm totally in love with this guy. His ghost propositioned me from a fountain. That's on my business card. A servant enters and then the king comes in afterwards and says, oh, sweetheart, I haven't forgotten your birthday. It's coming after the Feast of Ramadan. And then the prince comes into the room and he's like, hey, here's some soldier guys. They went to the assassins where they were hiding out and they're gone. So somebody in the palace must be a spy. Oh, I don't know who that could be. Dun, dun, dun. Then we cut back to Aisha and she's like, Elvis is like, how am I supposed to get in there? And she's like, oh, no, we're going to infiltrate the palace in disguise. And the tambourine girls, your friends here, will dance and distract the king, and then you'll kill him.
And, you know, disguise, subtlety is, you know.
Oh, yes. That's so awesome. So, and Elvis is like, how do we know that you won't just, like, kill the orphans? And then Aisha says, like this, because it's just silly. She's like, in 1,000 years, the Lord of Assassins has never broken a promise. It's just such a cheesy line. And then the fact that, like, I don't know. Are there such a thing as, like, an assassin who has a code? I guess that's what all assassin movies are about, but...
You might say he has a creed, an assassin's creed.
Nope, too creative. So, cut to the palace, girls dancing, more bongo. Elvis, so the room is just filled, you know, we're in a palace, so it's filled with lots of awesome colors and beautiful outfits, and Elvis is in his dark Jedi robes. Totally inconspicuous, as Colette was referring to earlier. Like, that's fine, whatever. Yeah. And so Elvis
he's come to collect Han Solo from Carbonite.
Yes. So Elvis walks up to the king, and the princess recognizes him. And so they arrest everyone except Billy Barty, who hides under some cushions. Because little people. And probably the second best song, because Elvis is supposed to be subdued and beaten in prison, is happening now.
It's called So Far From Paradise.
Yeah, so close yet so far from paradise. But yeah, I really think I was like enjoying that song because he's just like leaning up against the prison bars singing, like, which would totally be in character at the point.
Yeah, I felt like this was the best song of the movie, personally.
I think I just put second best because I said the best was probably the opening one where we couldn't see him. So we cut to a guard who, Anyway, Billy Barty, he like makes his way to the prison beating up guards. One guard is eating a big giant drumstick.
Like a dinosaur. That thing was enormous.
Turkeys were big back in the 60s. Anyway, and he beats up the guard with the drumstick. And Zaka is in the prison cell whining about his coming death. And most of the scenery is like unrecognizable because he's chewed it off. And the door opens. Elvis decides this is his last chance. He's going to take a swing at the guard and see he swings at the air because it was Billy Barty who opened the door. So he just sort of spins around in a comical way.
Sort of.
He puts a good effort into it.
Acting direction by Christopher Nolan, fight choreography by a 12-year-old girl.
Right. The girl who did the dance earlier.
Billy Barty has a bunch of rope, so they use some rope to climb down the prison tower, except for Billy Barty and Elvis, who then climb up higher. And they head to the roof and lower themselves through a skylight with some more rope. Elvis descends into the princess's chamber where the king is trying to comfort his daughter who is sick in bed because she's so in love with someone who's in the prison. The wise king decides to hear Elvis out because Elvis is like, hey, I wouldn't assassinate you because I love your daughter. And she's like, see, daddy?
Right.
I wish I could like say those lines verbatim. Oh wait, I just did. So they come up with this plan, which they don't tell us about. And this gong rings, and the prince wakes up, and a guard enters, and he hands him the king's seal, and he's like, "Look, the king's bed is full of blood, and he's missing, and the American has escaped." So then they cut to Zaka, who's back at the Prince of, or the, what is it, the Palace of Jackals. And he's being whipped by the assassins. And he tells the Lord of Assassins, I'm pretty sure Elvis must have killed the king. I don't know. I just got back here. But that's what he was going to do. And so at this point, like, I was still trying to, like, you know, I'm watching this movie. I'm going to do a podcast on it later. I'm still, I can do it. My willing suspension of disbelief is, is I still have some fuel in the tank. I'm ready. And then Elvis and the princess and the freaking king sneak into the Palace of Jackals to spy on all of this. And I was like, oh, right. Okay.
Yep.
It's not like you go hide because everyone wants you dead. It's like, hey, why don't you come with us into the murderous den?
With no weapons.
Right. No way to do our to defend yeah. ourselves. Except my mighty beard.
Yeah. Yes. And let's all wear Jedi robes.
That's right.
And so then the prince comes in, and he's now wearing the official seal, as the Lord of the Assassin points out. And he's come to pay the Lord of Assassins. Oh, my gosh. It was the prince.
Like, wow, Scoob.
Yes.
I feel very much like it's a Scooby-Doo episode at this point, because literally the prince is the first person in the movie that we see that's not Elvis, which is the same way every episode of Scooby-Doo works. It's the first person you see that's not a main character. That's who did it.
Well, yeah. And then the other part I thought was funny was like, I thought they were plotting all the way from the beginning, and then I started to waver because I was like, maybe this movie isn't that intelligent. but the issue came for me was I was like, hey, so when he goes back to the king and he's like, I was bringing Johnny Tyrone here and the assassins kidnapped him, man. I was like, and Aisha, right? They kidnapped Aisha, or... It's like, you're not selling it for me, buddy. But the Lord of Assassin double crosses him. And he's like, I know why you did this. You're going to bring some oil company in here. And I was like, oh, wow. Topical.
Modern.
Yes.
The best motivation in the whole movie, actually.
Yes, this is true. We should totally like redub this film. You're going to let the Keystone Pipeline go in. right. So he's like, you know what? You're going to be my puppet. I'm going to really lead this country and my assassins will bring you back to the palace or something like that. And I run the country. Ha ha ha. Meanwhile, Elvis and Billy Barty, they sneak over to the tambourine ladies and they say, give us your ankle bells. And so they move around the room and ring the bells, confusing the assassin henchmen.
Yes. So
Elvis rings it in the left corner and they go to go beat up Elvis because they don't know why that noise is coming. And then Barty rings it from another corner and they turn around. So... Anyway, Elvis gets behind the Lord of Assassins and threatens him unless the assassins give up. But now they need to take back the city and they need men to do that. Oh, no. Zaka, our plot glue, he's like, oh, I can provide that for a fee. So they cart the Lord of Assassins into town. He's all like tied up or something. And meanwhile, Zaka's friends join them thanks to Zaka's very stealthy dog barking call.
I know.
Yeah.
And this, I'm like, so if it's a 2000 year old, you know, setting where presumably there's tons of stray animals, I'm sure that a dog's howl is going to bring out all the like agitators in the city.
Right. Don't come up with something unique.
All I have in my notes is, why is the movie still going at this point?
Yeah, like
we've
you won.
Caught the main bad guy. It should just be done now.
Yeah. And all of these Middle East movies, like they, it seems like even no matter the year, like we always have to have like people scaling walls and running on rooftops. it's like parkour before parkour. So they tie the Lord of the Assassin to the cart And then they get all staged, ready to attack when the bad guys come out. And so playing into the trap for no reason whatsoever, they remove the gag on the Lord of Assassins. And he's like, hey, come free me. Which is just silly.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. The king, he heads to the palace because he's like, I got to give my brother the what's what. And then comes like all these ridiculous fight scenes. Elvis does like, he does this like weird Three Stooges like thing where you're like, oh, finally, we know this is a comedy. Like he's in a sword fight with some guy. The guy like knocks his sword away and Elvis slaps both sides of his face and shakes it and is like, and then like, he just like kicks the guy over or something. It was just so ridiculous.
Well, and these fight scenes were all with these assassins who in one of the earlier scenes at the beginning of the movie, like what, maybe 10 minutes in, all were carrying guns. But somehow right. all of these guns, presumably, which is why they thought they could kind of take over, are gone and they're all fighting with swords.
I don't know. I think there was only a few guns, but...
My question is, who would win in a choreographed fight? Elvis or Steve Urkel?
He's a black belt, isn't he? I don't know.
there's some very Zoidberg-like moves that Elvis does in this whole thing. He just like he's flopping around more than he's actually judo chopping anybody.
As I said, I was defeated after I saw the king sneaking around, being part of the plan.
Yep.
So I was almost done at that point. But then, for whatever reason, like during the crazy fight scene, like there is like, you know, a raised area where like a tree and like bricks around it or something like that. And like the bad guys chase Billy Barty around it. And there's like six bad guys to the point where like now they're like just all running around. And it just made me laugh. I laughed out loud. I was like, that's ridiculous. So it gets better because the king who I'm not sure that he has his SAG card. It might just be his mustache. his mustache has the card, but, right. The king, he steps into the palace and his brother, his traitorous bastard brother, is playing chess with Aisha. And so he swats the chessboard with his sword and he's like, this game's over, buddy. right. Which was really unconvincing. But to make it even better, like his brother gets up, pulls out his sword. And he's like, I fought to be the king. I'll fight you. And so then the king just like really poorly like tips over a table in front of them.
Right. Rah!
It would have been more convincing had he said, okay, you want to fight? Hold on a second. Let me move this out of the way. And like picked it up and set it against the wall. Because the way he kicked it was like, all right, you guys are done.
Yeah, there were a couple of those moments in this movie where as part of the choreography, somebody knocks something over like it's supposed to stop somebody else, and it's very clear from the framing in every single one of these instances that they could just walk around that thing. It would not take very long at all. It's not like you've blocked off some narrow corridor or hallway that knocking that table over is actually going to do anything. You literally just threw the apples to the floor. That's all you did. Well done.
yeah, it was just bad choreography.
Yeah.
So someone with an arrow somewhere in the fight, who knows, maybe Chuck Norris, shoots the guard with the gun, or shoots one of the assassins with a gun who just happens to be near his dear leader. And as he's dying, he starts firing the gun, which he hasn't done yet, and shoots the Lord of the Assassins, and everyone stops and looks. And then they just all cheer because, hey, we won the fight because we killed the Lord of the Assassins. Which, to Paul's point, like, we won already a long time ago when we captured him.
Yeah.
So, whatever, okay. And the princess is like, where's my dad? And Elvis is like, hey, went to the palace. I don't know. go take over. And she's like, oh, we have to help them, which is funny because, like, the fight scene music is playing and then the machine gun goes off and the guy, the Lord of the Assassin, dies. The music stops. Everyone's like, yay, we won. They all cheer. And she's like, where's my dad? And he's like, oh, he went to the palace. And she's like, we have to go see if he needs help. And so then they start playing the fight scene music again. It was really weird, maybe because I was watching it fast forward. So anyway, they find the king just hanging out with his brother, the prince. Yeah, they're not fighting. They're playing chess.
Yeah.
And he's like, I can't kill my own brother. I'm just going to send him into exile. And Elvis is like, he gets the like last line here. He's like, well, please don't exile him in America. Ba-dum-bump.
Yeah. And everybody laughs. Freeze frame, movie over. Just kidding. Yeah. Movie's not over.
Yes. That would be the way we end an 80 sitcom or A-Team. But or MacGyver, but no. So we cut to Elvis in Vegas singing Harem Holiday again, the song the movie opened with. But this time we get to see him performing it. And he's almost putting some action into it. The hips are almost moving. They're not lying at this point, but they're moving. And the king and his daughter in the audience with the two orphan children at their table. And then we cut to Billy Barty, and he's hanging out in the one-armed bandits, and he steals some money from someone at a slot machine, and he and Zaka play slots. Yay! Everybody wins. I didn't mean everyone. Wait, where are the tambourine girls? Oh, there they are on stage with Elvis. So they take the stage, and then Elvis continues singing the song in the audience, and he strolls over to the table, and as the song ends, he decides to make out with the princess in front of her dad.
Totally.
I was like, oh, man. I mean, that's something like I thought that was just like a weird thing that Colette and I did was make out in front of her father. I like the groan in stereo. That was awesome.
Sorry.
So the movie has finally ended. Oh, yes. So what do you think, Tina? Do you think this movie was so bad it was good?
No.
It was good for napping.
No, I fell asleep. That's not. Yeah. It's just bad.
Colette, did you?
It's still not as good as a boy and his dog.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. That's still my favorite.
Yes. That movie is like sort of, all right, that's silly. That's silly. That's Sally. And then the ending, you're like, what?
Oh, yeah. That was the best part.
Yes. Go watch A Boy and His Dog. Colette, what did you think of this film? Bad?
Good. You owe me another date night.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a fun, when Paul told me that we had another one of these videos, I got excited. And then as soon as like the first 5 minutes were on, I was like, yeah, I'm going to bed.
I was like, good news. We've got a movie to watch. Bad news. It's an Elvis movie.
This was my first Elvis movie and quite possibly my last Elvis movie.
You know what? I liked them when I was little, but I was little. You know,
yeah, that's the thing. I think I liked them when I was younger as well. I was like, oh, it's just fun, just like a Disney movie. It's just fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you sit down and hope to find some plot, you're gonna not get that. Yeah, I'm gonna go ahead and say this was bad as well. It does have its like, wow, that's so bad moments where it did entertain me, but overall I say probably not waste your time with this film.
Unless you're like a real Elvis fan. Like I was reading some of the reviews on IMDb and like there's some people are like, this is the best Elvis movie ever. The soundtrack's amazing. It's yeah, like you've drunk the Elvis Kool-Aid, you know? So I think, you know, if you like people singing who are high on Valium and you... you really like Elvis, you'll probably enjoy the movie.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Paul?
Yeah, it's bad.
I didn't want to leave you out, but I knew your answer.
That's all. It's bad.
So we should move on and get this done with. What about recommendations? Do you have any recommendations, Colette?
For musicals?
Yeah,
or
whatever.
Just for... well, go see Pirates of Penzance.
There you go. That's which version?
Kevin Kline.
Kevin Kline. Is Christy McNichol in that one? Or is that a different pirate movie?
I don't know.
All right.
My favorite, I love Singing in the Rain too. If you like sort of old time.
I knew you were going to
recommend that. You know, the tap dancing thing. And so that would be another one to go see if you enjoy musicals. Those are my recommendations.
All right. Tina, do you have any recommendations? Boy and his dog?
As in like So Bad It's Good?
Yeah, or musicals, whatever.
The Goonies.
Goonies.
Yeah.
It's funny. Every time, like, I've been making Colette watch lots of movies because she missed out on so many. So I forced them on her quite often. And I think you've seen that one, haven't you?
I have. I'd be scared to see it again because I really liked The Goonies when I was a kid. And I'm a little worried that if I watched it as an adult, that some of the shine might go from my memory.
Oh, yeah, it does.
So I kind of want to leave it in that, oh, I liked that movie, but I don't need to see it again.
I think it's still good, though.
Oh, you guys are messed up.
I think it is, too, I think.
Wasn't there
Come on, the kid
too?
The kid's sticking his hand like in that blender. I had nightmares for forever.
And see, I don't even remember that scene.
I don't either.
Wow.
It traumatized me. And so did that dude with the weird eye.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sloth, was that the guy's name?
Yeah, I think that was his name, Sloth.
Hey, you guys. Yeah. Rocky Road.
Oh, I wish that you had asked us about this earlier because, you know, I know there are a bunch of really bad good movies because those are my favorite. And I just can't think of any off the top of my head. I'll have to mention them next time.
That's fine. I completely understand that. I get whacked out when we're doing the podcast. My brain's like, I can't focus. Must read. Paul, do you have a recommendation?
Just go back and watch Zardoz.
That's like way up there with Boy and His Dog.
Yeah, those two selections from earlier in this season of Film Frown. Very good if you're looking for So Bad It's Good, I think.
You know, I'd like to know how he wore that banana hammock the entire time without it being distracting. Like they must have duct taped his dong down or something.
Yes.
What are you looking at, Zardoz?
And meanwhile, in this film, I'm sure like Elvis had like four pairs of socks and those like parachute pants he was wearing.
What? Had, like, I think I missed that
like,
part.
Loose fitting green pants on, and like they were just so loose fitting. Like at one point, I was. Like when he was moving around. Oh, like when he gets in the water, I was like, man, that's a lot of fabric just to be hanging off of you. And I was like, oh, they're not going to show that because it's going to be stuck to something. But yeah, I just thought they were very unflattering pants. You have a sex symbol. Let's put him in really baggy clothes is what I'm getting at.
And then turn on a fan. And right at his crotch.
And I would recommend something I saw recently. I can be musical, I suppose. The History of Future Folk isn't a bad film. I don't know what country those guys are from, but they are two folk musicians, kind of like Flight of the Conchords. And their whole deal is that they're aliens from another planet, and all their fun banjo-y folk songs are songs about space and the planets and things.
What?
Yeah, it's they're, I guess they're a band and possibly a comic troupe first, but they made a film, and the film is about one of them comes to Earth. He's going to blow up the planet, and he's in like a Home Depot. And Muzak comes on, and he stops from pushing the button, and he falls in love with Earth because he loves music and he's never heard it before. And so that's the plot of the movie, is he lands on Earth, falls in love, meets a woman, plays music, and then they send like some evil aliens come to kill him or something, and they send another person to destroy the planet, and he finds him. He's like, I couldn't do it. And he's like, why not? He's like, listen to this. And he's like, oh my God, that's amazing. So they make a band.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. And you think me describing it is silly, but like, it is a pretty low budget film. And I think that's part of its charm, unlike this film that we watched. So like, even their alien costumes, which they decide to wear on stage because, hey, bands have costumes, right?
Sure.
Like Kiss. So even their alien costumes, like their helmets, are like buckets. So it's cut out for a visor. So yeah, it was entertaining, definitely.
I was going to say there was a movie that Tina and I fairly recently watched that's on Netflix right now. I believe it's called The Machine. And it's it is also a sci-fi, but I think it was an independent film, somewhat fairly low budget. But it's about a scientist who is trying to, he's trying to hit upon the correct kind of AI. And at the beginning of the movie, you see him trying to help this, soldier basically who has suffered brain damage in his via whatever war they're fighting, and so he's trying to use AI to like augment and improve his life, and that ends up kind of playing a larger role later on because he ultimately ends up creating a fully autonomous AI robot, basically. And he's sort of funded by the military, and the military is trying to take this robot and turn it obviously into a soldier of some kind that they can use to continue fighting their wars without sacrificing people. But the government doesn't particularly like that his AI is so intelligent that it has like kind of a soul or morality or whatever, kind of questions things a little bit. And it kind of goes from there. So it's pretty interesting. It's not a musical of any kind, but it is fun, kind of near. It's not post-apocalyptic, but it's sort of like the world is on the edge of, if things go wrong, that's the direction it's headed. So,
yeah, she's very creepy because she's so innocent / powerful.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Yes, there's a very, also in that film, there's a very short circuit-esque moment, like when Johnny Five like kills a butterfly and he's like, oh no, reassemble the butterfly.
Yeah, right. Right.
Teaching AIs about death is always fun. Yeah, so we should do the whole like sign-off-y thingamajigger. Where can people find you, Colette?
You can find me on Twitter at Sunday Ideas.
Sweet.
Other than that, in Canada.
Cool. It's not a large country at all.
No. Well, usually, you know, you go traveling and you say from Canada, like, oh, I know someone in Toronto. You must know them. So I figure I'm in Canada.
And you can find me on the Twitters at Sick Days, which is SIKKDAYS, because I have to be difficult.
Teeny, how about you?
I am on Twitter also at Teeny Devil, TeeNyDVL.
Boom.
And I am at Paul D, P-A-U-L-D.
Cool. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I just wanted to say, if you're listening live, enjoy your holidays. This awful show about Harum Scarum, this awful movie about Harum Scarum, is the probably concludes this season of Film Frown. So thanks for listening. And if you're listening as on a podcast in months to come, then hey, maybe the new season has started and you should check us out live on Thursday nights.
And I have a request for next year.
Okay.
Next year, this time, we need to watch a bad Christmas movie.
Yes.
I thought about that briefly, but I was like, well, it's live right now, but then it'll be released like probably in February.
Well, how about National Lampoon?
That's true. A good bad movie. And yeah, hopefully we'll be back maybe recording or doing live shows in mid-January and start releasing more Film Frowns in March, perhaps, so we can have a buffer since we want to release shows to you once a week.
That sounds about right.
Sweet. It's always good when I don't just make stuff up. Cool. Well, thanks for listening live. Have a great evening.
Thank you much.
I stop because Colette has paused by the microphone to say something, and I stop, and then she just giggles. She totally faked me out. I don't get to do this because Paul and I, when we do the podcast, I can't see him to see that he wants to say something. So he just totally took advantage of that. That was hilarious. Awesome. Good job. She's not even going to talk now. It's great.
Good night and good luck.
Chris, I didn't burp this time.
Oh.
You get more out of life when you go out to a movie. Thank you for coming out to the drive-in tonight. As you leave, please drive carefully. And come back soon. Please replace the speaker on its rack when you're ready to leave. Failure to do so will damage both the speaker and your car. We'll be grateful, and so will the patrons who follow you.